Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
It's so good to have you tuned in. Thank you for joining us. I'm Neil Stavem. Ted Ross at the controls. This is Connecting Faith. And Ted, I want you and the listeners to consider this scenario and then ask yourself how you should or would respond.
Okay.
So social media, you're called naive, ignorant, and dangerous. The majority are presenting so-called indisputable evidence of where you're wrong and telling you to get in step with others. Even the president of the U.S. is publicly stating that the best thing you can do is the very thing to which you are opposed.
Right.
So now the question is, what is the subject that we're talking about? And assuming that you're in the minority view, how do you feel and react?
Well, I mean, as a believer, it sounds like you're talking maybe about just being a Christian, but I find that hard to believe.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say the president, but, I don't know. So, yeah, that's an interesting scenario.
Several, you could probably think of several possible topics or positions.
Yeah, certainly.
Well, now consider how you would feel or react if you're in the majority view. And now how do you feel and act toward those who hold this minority position?
I feel a little more equipped to engage them, probably,
yeah.
Right? Because you have support.
Well, today we're going to talk about how we influence each other and what it takes to persuade someone to change their position. Now, it's not just going to be a political discussion, although certainly that will play a part in it. But it does relate to our mission here at Faith Radio to help connect faith to life every day. Because,
yeah.
You know, how do we apply biblical principles to daily life? And so today we're going to talk about it. We're going to be talking about Christian influence in a post-Christian world.
It's so good because there's so much engagement going on, and a lot of it's angry and tense, whether it be online or in person. So this will be great.
We'll find out from Tim Muehlhoff. He's back with us. We're going to talk about his new book, Winsome Persuasion. But speaking of books, first, a big thank you to those who attended our Christian Writers Conference on the campus of the University of Northwestern. It was a sold-out event this past Saturday.
Wonderful day. A lot of people said they really enjoyed it, and we're doing it again next year.
Yeah. So thank you for those that attended, and we had a chance to meet a lot of listeners, introduce some others to Faith Radio. So just want to say welcome if you're new to Faith Radio or maybe listening in the app or the online stream. Of course, you can find out more about us anytime online, myfaithradio.com, myfaithradio.com. Let's jump into today's conversation with Tim Muehlhoff. Tim is a professor of communication at Biola University, and he teaches classes in family communication, interpersonal communication, persuasion, and gender, and he's authored a number of books. We talked to him, I think, just recently about the God Conversation, using stories and illustrations to explain your faith. He and his wife, Noreen, are frequent speakers at Family Life Marriage Conferences, which I would think would be just another reason you'd want to go to a Family Life Marriage Conference to hear somebody like Tim. And we should probably have Noreen on sometime, Tim, shouldn't we, just to kind of hear the other half of the story? Wouldn't that be good or not?
I don't know if that would be good.
Yeah, you got such a good thing going here. Why, why spoil it? Well, welcome back, Tim. Good to have you on.
Boy, it's great to be back.
So this new book you co-wrote with Richard Langer, and who's also a professor there with you at Biola, and I know you teach some classes together and think alike. But this is a wonderful resource. I know people are going to really enjoy Winsome Persuasion, Christian Influence in a Post-Christian World. And I guess it really is just kind of addressing the world in which we live in, because it is pretty contentious, it seems, isn't it?
Boy, Neil, you know, Americans disagree on a lot of things, but we also agree on a lot of things. There's a new study that just came out, 2017. 79% of Americans say that the presidential election was uncivil. 97% all agree that the president should be civil, and 69% believe that incivility has reached crisis levels in the United States. So for all of our differences, I think we all agree, hey, things have gotten out of hand today, and the way that we talk to each other is not productive, it's not civil, but people don't know what to do about that. And I think that's where Christians can step in, although many people would think, boy, the last person I'm going to talk to about civility is a Christian, but I think we have a great opportunity to step in and talk about sharing truth in love and in civility.
You do suggest there are maybe three approaches to the way that Christians, I mean, if we dare to speak in public, we tend to use maybe one of three voices. Which one's going to be best for a chance for success? Just talk about those.
Well, I think all three are biblical. All three are endorsed by the scriptures. One would be what we call the prophetic voice. That's where you just stand up and you say, I'm sorry, this is wrong. Based on God's word, this is wrong. The second one is the pastoral voice that comes along and says, listen, even though you're wrong, I can imagine this causes you a lot of pain. I can imagine that there's hurt in your life, and I want to empathize with that. The last voice is what we call the persuasive voice, which means, yeah, I think you're wrong, but I want to persuade you towards my position. What I think's happened, Neil, is that we've fallen in love with the prophetic voice, where we're just frustrated and we stand up and say, I'm sorry, this is what the Bible teaches about marriage. I'm sorry, this is what the Bible teaches about God. And if that doesn't fit your worldview or your ethics, well, I'm sorry. God's word is clear. And if that doesn't work, then we act like a tourist in a foreign country who's asking where the bathroom is, right? It's like, excuse me, where's the bathroom? And the person doesn't understand us, so we yell louder, where's the bathroom? And I think today we're known for the prophetic voice. And so I think we argue, let's go towards the pastoral voice and also go towards the persuasive voice. And guess what's going to happen? It's going to make our prophetic ability even more successful.
You do spend some time in this wonderful new book, Winsome Persuasion, helping us understand, I guess, maybe the theory or the, you know, what it means in the way in which we communicate. You talk about publics and counterpublics. So do some definition for us.
Yeah, counterpublic is just a fancy academic word that's thrown around. It simply means if you are the public, then you have the dominant perspective. Everybody's on your side. The question you threw out in the very beginning, the answer was immunization was the issue that you were talking about. Yeah. So most people today are on the side of immunization. You have to be immunized to attend an American school, a public school. Well, there's a lot of people, the minority, who feel like, no, that's going against my religious conviction. That's going against my belief of maybe the effects of immunization on forms of autism. So I should not be forced to do this. Well, if those people are what we call the counterpublic. They are the minority perspective, and yet they want to be heard. They want to have their day in court. They want people to listen to their convictions. Well, this whole book is based on the premise the Christian perspective has moved since the 1950s. Today, we're considered the minority perspective. At least conservative Christianity is seen as the minority perspective, that we're not tolerant, that we're hate mongers, that we're anti-gay, and all these different things. And so people look at us today, and the prophetic voice doesn't work. Why? Because they don't accept the Bible the way we accept the Bible. There's a study we mentioned in the book where most people view the Bible today as a collection of stories created by people, and they're no more persuasive than other stories. Well, we say, no, it's the Word of God, but people don't accept that. So we just can't come at it with a prophetic voice, assuming that the Bible still has the kind of cultural weight it once had. We're going to have to make an argument for that, why the Bible should be listened to and not the Quran or the Bhagavad Gita. And that's where people just get frustrated and say, really? I can't just come out and say, thus says the Lord? And I want to say today, I don't think it's going to have the persuasive influence we want it to.
You know, it's a challenge for, I guess, any of us to, if we have been in a majority position, whatever that is, to suddenly sort of find ourselves in the minority position. I mean, is that a whole different strategy, or is it just, as you said, does it just mean that we shout louder?
No, it's a whole different strategy when you're in the minority. I mean, how do you, you know, if every television show you watch, if every news program you look at, if social media is decidedly against your position and even ridicules it, even makes fun of it. Well, now the question is, okay, how do I speak to the dominant public? I mean, you can always just create a blog and your friends read it, you know what I mean? Or you can have a Twitter account and it's just your friends reading it. Well, but that's not what we want to do. We want to actually engage the dominant perspective. So that question becomes, well, how do you get the credibility that people will listen to you? How do you get the platform that people actually consider what you have to say? The church has often reacted, well, I'll just create my own small group. We'll homeschool kids. We'll take them out of public school because they don't listen to us anyway. We'll create our own Christian movies because we don't like what Hollywood does, and so we'll create our own little movies and be content with horrible scores on Rotten Tomatoes, but our friends go see the movie. So sometimes the desire to retreat is what has happened. But in the New Testament, Christians did not retreat in the New Testament. We argue that there's a lot of historical evidence that Christians really did engage the culture in very productive ways.
We'll talk in the moments ahead about how we can do that in today's post-Christian world. We're talking Christian influence in a post-Christian world. That is the subtitle of Tim Muehlhoff's new book. He wrote it with co-author Rich Langer. And the book is called Winsome Persuasion, and it comes from InterVarsity Press. And we do have some copies to give away, and would love to have you get a copy of this. If you've read any of Tim's works before, you know what a great writer and thinker he is, and looking forward to the conversation ahead. So give us a call. Sign up for that drawing. We'll do that at the top of the hour. Three copies of Winsome Persuasion to give away. 877-933-2484. 877-93-FAITH. All right, just ahead, we'll review some good examples of ways that we can perhaps engage winsomely, and we'll talk a bit about St. Patrick and others. That's all coming up here on Connecting Faith. Christians should be noted for speaking hope, and speaking love, and speaking life. That's probably not the label that most would place on us, certainly conservative Christianity. We're talking today how we can have influence in a post-Christian world. It's the subtitle of the new book from Tim Muehlhoff and Rich Langer. It's called Winsome Persuasion. Tim is a professor of communication at Biola University, and author of great books like I Beg to Differ, and co-author of Authentic Communication, Christian Speech, Engaging Culture. We had him on not too long ago talking about his latest called The God Conversation, using stories and illustrations to explain your faith. And what we're talking about, you know, how do we find a place to have dialogue with the important issues of the day? And so, Tim, we mentioned that you sort of touched on there were several characteristics of what you call the counter-public. And maybe we just define those again and kind of summarize them.
Sure. A public, that's the dominant perspective. That's the majority. That's what you see on TV when you turn it on. It's the majority perspective. But you hold the minority perspective, which we call a counter-public. And today, as Christians, we're frustrated because we feel like, hey, when they're talking about issues on CNN or MSN, where are the Christian perspectives? When they're kicking around issues like same-sex marriage, transgendered issues, or whatever, where are the Christian scholars? I mean, I teach at a great university, but Biola professors, by and large, aren't being asked to show up on TV shows to present the conservative Christian perspective. Well, that's really frustrating. We don't have a seat at the table. So the whole question becomes, how do you get a seat at the table? And that's what the book is about, is practical way. And again, the book is written, Neil, not so much for national dialogues. Few of us are airplanes flying in that kind of atmosphere, you know, that you're going to get asked to speak at CNN. So our book is written for the local people. It's people who live in a community and they want the Christian perspective to be heard. So how, as community members, do you get the Christian perspective out there? And I think this is an old adage I heard from my Sunday school teacher when I became a Christian at age 13. He said, people do not care what you think until they know that you care. Boy, there's a ton of good communication theory behind that, Neil. So we've got to show people first, since they don't want to listen to our perspective. I don't give a rip what you think about marriage. I don't care what you think about premarital sex. How do we get them to listen? Is we show them first that we love them and that we are concerned for everybody within our community. And that is supremely biblical. That's what Christians did in Antioch.
I want to follow up on that because I was thinking, you know, we want to influence change or make our case, but decisions that come down from the federal level, or I mean, how, What do we do once the Supreme Court decides? Is it enough to be able to convince our neighbor or have influence in the community? Or do we need to have this global mindset?
Yes, we do need to have a national mindset. And again, in the book, we absolutely advocate that you do everything at your disposal. And that can be, you know, writing letters to senators. It can be marches on Washington. It can be petitions. So we don't neglect any of that. We just say, though, your credibility dissipates the higher you go up the political chain, right? So when you're at the highest level, right, trying to influence the Supreme Court or something like that, well, you know, you're just one little voice of a person that you've never heard of. But in your community, you actually can have a name and a reputation because of the good that your family has done or the good that you your church has done. Let me give you an example, Neil. We have wildfires here, and so our kids don't get snow days, they get wildfire days in California. Well, so wildfires hit where we live, Brea, California, and they devastated the one high school in Brea. All the shrubbery, all the landscaping was burnt to a crisp. Well, the school didn't have money to replace it. So what happened is four churches got together, approached the school board, and said, listen, on four consecutive Sundays, we are going to come and replace all the shrubbery, all the landscaping free of charge. Well, you can imagine the school board was like, yeah, love it. And the head of the school board and the people on the school board actually joined the churches on every single weekend to plant shrubbery. Now, think about this for a second, Neil. Now something happens at school that Christians are upset about, right? You're teaching some form of sexual education that we just don't agree with or something like that. Now we show up and we say, hey, we have some concerns. And they're like, oh, yeah. You're the guys with the shrubbery. Hey, thanks for that, by the way. Thank you so much for the time, money that you donated. Man, that was awesome. Now, what do you got? What's the matter? Christians just want to show up without having done the shrubbery part, right? I've never seen you before, but you show up at my school board meeting and you're angry, and that's supposed to be persuasive. So that's kind of the difference that we're arguing in Winsome Persuasion.
I guess that's in the opposition category, and you know we want to get to engagement, but there's another one that seems pretty strong, the withdrawal. And I'm wondering, you know, Ron Dreher just recently you've been talking about, you know, maybe we need to regroup. Is that something where we have to consider? Is there value in that?
Well, there's absolute value in that, and I don't want to be harshly critical of this book, though I do think our book stands in opposition to what he's arguing for. We do argue for times of withdrawal because, boy, you need time just to regroup. I mean, it gets pretty lonely when you're the minority perspective day in and day out. But that withdrawal was never meant to be permanent. And the longer we pull away from our neighbors to regroup, you're not cultivating social capital. Right? If we're withdrawing, there's no landscaping being done in the light of wildfires. You're not participating in building up the food bank. You're not helping with blood drives. And so I want to say that we have times of withdrawal, but you don't stop engaging during those times. I think we can do both, be engaging and also having times where we pull away, maybe certainly during Sundays to regroup and edify, but we're always going back into the battle on Monday. And I think churches need to think deeply about what is our social capital in a community. In other words, if this church wasn't here anymore, if we shut the doors tomorrow, would anybody miss us except the people that attend our church? I think that is the fundamental question that churches need to ask is, if we were to leave the scene, would the community miss us? Which, that's an interesting question.
It's a hard one to face sometimes because you've been talking about credibility. I mean, I think, well, it's one thing to be winsome, another thing to be credible. And somehow we think, well, we're credible if we get our apologetics straight.
Oh, you're right, Neil. Good. And I think that's part of withdrawal is, hey, it's good to know and have experts speak on why we believe the Bible is inspired, why we believe Jesus rose from the dead, why we believe Jesus is God, why we believe Christianity is the only way to get to God. Man, that's essential for building up the faith of our young people and even adults. But all of that is for a purpose. The purpose is you build up your faith so that you can go out and actually share it with other people. And that's the part that I'm kind of missing today. So, Neil, I think today we need to step in and ask our communities, What do you need? How can we help you guys right now? What is it that we can provide that we see going on? The homeless issue, blood drives, the transgendered issue. Where can we step in today and help our community members? And sometimes churches are too inward focused, is my assessment.
You talk about, you give several examples in the book of people like St. Patrick. Say a bit more about what we could learn from his approach.
Well, St. Patrick's a great example of, boy, we tend to think today that it's darker than it's ever been. Like, this is the worst time in the world to be a Christian is right now. Well, we fill the book with historical examples of Christian counterpublics who've been super effective. And boy, talk about St. Patrick. When he went to Ireland, Ireland's economy was built on two things, warfare and slavery. So he shows up. How do you make an impact? Well, what he does is he creates these communities and invites people to the community. Anybody can come. If you're tired of barbarism, if you're tired of the hostility that's out there, come into our community and you will experience something different. You'll experience a community that's built on kingdom values, not the values that you find outside in the landscape of Ireland. And people, Neil, people came in droves. So some could say, well, isn't that withdrawal? And I would say, no, it's not withdrawal. It's creating a community and opening the doors, saying, hey, everybody is welcome. We won't turn away anyone because we want you to experience life as we believe that God has it. So again, our churches ought to be open to everybody. And we shouldn't decide things based on political stances, right? The gospel needs to be free for everybody. But then people won't ever come to our churches until we go out to them and we basically show that we're people, we care about everybody. You don't have to agree with us morally or politically. We still care for you. And Neil, I think at the end of the day, what separated the early church is we did it to our enemies. The very people who would harm us, we go out, Paul says, hey, especially with your enemies, I want you to feed them, give them drink. And I think today we don't like that very much. We want to hit back. And Paul's saying, no, feed your enemies, and I promise you the Holy Spirit will be at work.
Now, that's a challenge that we need to address, and we're going to do that more in the moments ahead. We'll take a quick little break and come back, talk more with Tim Muehlhoff about his new book called Winsome Persuasion, Christian Influence in a Post-Christian World. And we know the world in which we live. And, you know, we've yet considered, we're dogmatists, we're out of touch. What does it mean to find a place to be making our voice heard, make a case, to gain some credibility? How do we do that? We'll find out more in the moments ahead. I want to encourage you to stay tuned for the conversation. And we do have some copies of Tim's new book to give away. So you can sign up for that at 877-933-2484. You can give us a call and give us your contact information. We'll do the drawing here at the top of the hour. Or if it's easier to just drop us a note, you can go to myfaithradio.com and click on the Connecting Faith show page and leave us your information there. Or 877-93-FAITH. And if you have a question, too, we'd love to have you join the conversation. We want to find out a little bit about, how do we begin to present an opposing view? And C.S. Lewis talks about something called watchful dragons. We're going to get to that more. Tim Muehlhoff from Biola University in just a moment. Stay tuned.
Words of my mouth and the thoughts of my heart, bless your name, Jesus.
It's a good prayer. From Psalm 19, may the words of my mouth, the meditation of my heart, be pleasing in thy sight, O Lord, my rock and my redeemer. Is it possible to be persuasive and civil at the same time? Boy, in today's culture, that is a good question. We're getting some reflection on it with Tim Muehlhoff. Tim's a professor of communication at Biola University, teaches classes in family communication, interpersonal communication, persuasion, gender, authored a number of great books. He and his wife, frequent speakers at Family Life marriage conferences as well. His latest book is called Winsome Persuasion, Christian Influence in a Post-Christian World. And as we've talked to Tim, it seems that, because we have moved into this minority position, I mean, we still tend to maybe dismiss others' opinions that, we don't deem as thoughtful or reasonable or certainly not biblical. How do we not be dismissive?
Well, isn't it ironic, Neil, that as the minority perspective, we are angry that we keep getting dismissed, right? We're not asked. People don't care about our perspective, or they belittle it, or they mock it. And yet we turn around with feminist perspective or a postmodern perspective or pick the political party you don't believe in, their perspective, and we just belittle it, and then we're mad that people do that back to us. Aristotle said your credibility would be based on one very important factor. Can you argue both sides of an issue? And can you do it fairly? And that's what I do with my students at Biola University, Neil, is I say to them, what's one of your greatest political convictions? What's one of your greatest religious convictions? And they come back with them. That's okay. Now I want you to write a 10-page paper on the other perspective. And they're like, no, I can't do that. Of course you can do that. But we've just learned not to do it. We often belittle the opposition as they belittle us, and we wonder why we're in what one communication theorist calls gridlock. Right? You belittle me, I'm going to belittle you. Make fun of my position, I'm going to make fun of your position. No, Aristotle said, can you step back and objectively see it from both perspectives? And I think, Neil, that we've almost virtually lost the ability to do that as Christians because we view arguing the other side as condoning the other side. And I just don't buy that premise.
Do you think that's true that you said you... This professor said gridlock is rooted in religious beliefs. Do you think that's the case all the time?
Well, it can be, okay. Especially the way we tend to do it today. Let me give you an example. In my school, which is a conservative religious school, I love Biola, Biblical Institute of Los Angeles is what Biola stands for. I have my students read the Quran cover to cover. When they finish doing that, they are part of 1% of American Christians who have ever read another book of another faith tradition, and parents initially went berserk. I did not send my daughter, this one woman, I did not send my daughter to Biola to read the Quran. And I said, can I ask why you sent her here? Well, I want her to be a Christ follower. Well, part of that is the Great Commission. 1 out of 5 people in the world self-identify as a Muslim. So if we're going to try to be persuasive, we better understand what a Muslim believes. And my goodness, the Quran is one of the greatest works of literature ever written. So my students read it cover to cover, and then their first assignment isn't to dismantle it. Their first assignment is, now I want you to go back and I want you to find 15 areas that the Bible agrees with the Quran. Now I get more calls from parents.
Sure.
My wife was like, honey, don't do this before you get tenure. Please, yeah. Can you wait until you get tenure before you do this assignment? But, Neil, think about that. All they're doing is reading it and finding points of agreement. Now, we're going to get to critique. I promise. But it's this whole semester-long class. I had one dad say to me, Neil, and I think this is an interesting indictment of our young Christians. He said this, how will you sleep at night if one of your students reads the Quran and walks away from the faith? And I said to this dad respectfully, I said, sir, if all it took was for your son to read a book and walk away from the faith, he was going to do it eventually. Better to do it in a controlled situation where I can put the pieces back together. But if your only strategy is locking the liquor cabinet, right? That's it. That's the way we keep our kids from alcohol. What happens when they leave and every liquor cabinet is unlocked? They never bought into our values. So we need to expose our students. And again, this is all age appropriate, of course, but expose people to other perspectives, and not a bad offering of that perspective, but the very best version of what's out there to help our students create antibodies.
It's almost like we've created this unintended consequences as Christians. We shelter our kids, and then that maybe that overprotection leads to a lack of empathy.
Well, lack of empathy and a lack of conviction. So we quote a fascinating communication theory called inoculation theory that's been very interesting. It's been proved in a lot of different ways. And basically, I'll let people read the examples in the book are amazing of this theory. But it basically says this. If you keep people from the alternative perspective, you actually make them susceptible to the weakest form of that argument because they don't have antibodies. they have no reaction against that because you kept it from them. So when they do find out atheists have good arguments against Christianity, right, they then feel a deep distrust towards their teachers and authority figures. In other words, saying, hey, did you know those arguments were out there? And we say, well, yeah, but we wanted to shield you from them. They're like, why? Why did you shield me from that? Are there not good answers to respond? And what else have you shielded me from that now I'm suspicious of everything that you taught me? So that's right. That's a big consequence. And lack of empathy is that we think atheists are idiots. We think people who disagree with the Christian perspective are morons. And why empathize with a moron? So we really do need to give them the best versions of what's out there. And again, I wouldn't do this with a freshman, but I would certainly do this with a junior and a senior because they're about to go into the real world.
Yeah. You referenced C.S. Lewis in the statement. He talks about getting past the watchful dragons of the heart. So talk about some, what are some effective strategies to get past those imposing barriers? I mean, if we do actually get the opportunity to address a group or maybe a neighbor with an opposing view.
Well, in the book, we quote a man who did a lifelong study of military generals. And he said, all of these generals agree on one principle. You can't do a frontal attack unless you have massive strength. A frontal attack consolidates the enemy. He said, you have to attack from the rear. And as Christians, we are horrible at attacking from the rear. And again, that's what Lewis is saying. The watchful dragons will see a frontal attack in a heartbeat. The power of the arts, Neil, is that it gets around my defenses. So in my class, we watch Modern Family, one of the most decorated shows in the history of American television, and it is its agenda is as clear as you could be, right? That it's absolutely pro-same-sex marriage, but you are laughing as you watch it. In my persuasion theory class, we teach laughter is the first level of acceptance. So, through music, through art, through thoughtful primetime television programs, we're laughing and it's going around our defenses. Christians, we feel like it has to be frontal, right? So if we do use the arts, we do movies like God Is Not Dead 1 and 2, right?
Yeah.
Or we do movies like Fireproof that have a study guide that goes with them. I think a general rule, Neil, for Christian artists, if your movie comes with a study guide, it's probably not a good idea. It's probably a frontal attack. So we need to have much subtler versions of our message out there where the Christianity is sort of kind of hiding in the background, because if people see it coming frontally, their defenses go up and they're not going to listen to any of it.
You used the example of Harry Beecher Stowe, of course, in that powerful, influential novel. But I was, and you can say a bit more about that, but it's interesting that she still had to do a follow-up piece that was maybe somewhat more factual. So does that mean that story isn't enough, that we still have to get the facts at some point?
Well, I would want to wed both of them. I mean, I do teach a persuasion class. So there's what we call proclamation, which is where you put your stuff out there. A proclamation message would be, let me give you 5 reasons Christianity is the only way to get to God. Let me give you 10 reasons Jesus rose from the dead. But here's the point of the book, Neil. No one's going to read that. There is nobody, the public isn't going to read it. Now, maybe we'll read it, right? We love C.S. Lewis, but out in the general public, he has no credibility. And now the Chronicles of Narnia do. See, that's the beauty of Lewis, is even non-Christians read the Chronicles of Narnia. But so, yeah, proclamation's great if you're the majority. If you're the minority, you have to find ways that people are going to be open to what, if it was proclaimed to them, they would reject. So we need to have subtle messages that are out there through the arts. And I think we can find ways of doing that, but we're going to have to give our artists permission that they don't have to proclaim the name of Jesus in every song, movie, or book that they do. They can be much subtler than that to get people thinking about things maybe from a broad Christian perspective. And Harriet Beecher Stowe, she was going up against people like abolitionist William Garrison, who wrote this in a speech concerning abolition. I will not equivocate. I will not excuse, I will not retreat a single inch, and I will be heard. Well, that's proclamation. And Harriet Beecher Stowe was watching how uncivil the conversations were about abolition. And so she said, you know what, I'm going to write a book. and invite people to see the world through the eyes of slaves. And when Abraham Lincoln met her, reportedly he said, "So this is the woman who started the Civil War." Right? It really changed the hearts and minds of people as her novel, which was radical at the time.
Say, we only about 90 seconds or so left, but are there any guidelines for linking arms and connecting with others in common concern? As you just gave that example, I mean, we're good at winning the battle and losing the war.
Yeah, we have a whole chapter on loose connections, which means find out what your community really cares about and the needs of your community, then link arms with somebody. Now, I go to a church of like 5,000 people that we have enough resources, Neil, that we can tackle every social concern by ourselves. We have the money. But let's link arms with non-Christian groups who care about the homeless, who care about foster care system. And in the book, we give a ton of great, unlikely loose connections between conservative Christians, like Focus on the Family, and liberals, like a newspaper called The Independent, that got together and focused on foster care for one day in Colorado. So let's look for ways that we can link arms with people. And you don't have to – I mean, I love what the new president, Jim Daly, said of Focus on the Family. Hey, we're big boys and girls here. We know we don't agree with everything The Independent newspaper says, and they don't agree with everything we say. But we can focus on foster care today and make a big difference. And they did.
Well, we've just scratched the surface of a very fascinating conversation that's spelled out in the new book, Winsome Persuasion, Christian Influence in the Post-Christian World. It's written by Tim Muehlhoff and Rick Langer. Tim is a professor of communication at Biola University, written a number of great books. I encourage you to check out his resources, his writing, and always thoughtful. Tim, we always enjoy the opportunity to connect with you. Thanks so much for coming on again today.
Oh, my pleasure, Neil. Thank you.
Winsome Persuasion. We do have some copies of the book to give away, so sign up for that. You'll want to get a copy, and we'll do the drawing here in about 15 minutes. Talking about how we can sometimes be a pain in the neck, we're going to talk about not being a pain in your back with Lisa Marone. It's our Monday Health Minute coming up in just a moment. Stay tuned. You're listening to Connecting Faith. So glad to have you along today. And as is our privilege on Mondays to connect with Lisa Marone, every other Monday anyway. Lisa provides a Monday morning health tip via email, which you can sign up for, by the way, at lisamarone.com. And we like to just take those and use them as opportunities to discuss about the better health. Lisa is a physical therapist, a professor, author, and a speaker who encourages us to get healthy, for heaven's sake. She's authored books on areas like sleeping well and diabetes and overcoming back and neck pain. And we're going to talk a little bit about back pain today. You know, the promise of summer invites us to come outdoors and dig around in the dirt. But for some, this is a highly anticipated time of year. But for those who suffer from back pain, the very thought of bending over and squatting down for long periods makes them reach instinctively for their back muscles to begin rubbing. And Lisa, I can relate. Welcome, by the way. Good to have you on again. Let's talk. You know, if we have chronic back pain, do we just give up the idea of gardening or other similar activities?
Well, I certainly didn't want to do that. When my back started bothering me, about a decade, I had a number of years of a problematic disc in my low back, but I absolutely loved gardening. And so I had to figure a way around that because I was unwilling to go through a summer without dirt in my fingernails.
Well, and I think most of us don't want to have back pain limit us from doing things. So are there some things that we can do to, assuming that, you know, the back pain isn't debilitating, things that we can do actually to enjoy a bit of outdoor activity?
Yeah, you know what, Neil, I kind of developed a 1-2-3 approach to this. It was, what do I do before I garden? What do I do while I'm gardening, and what do I do after so that I don't suffer for having gardened? And so before I would garden, I started just thinking really hard about the ergonomics about gardening. You know, most gardeners just bend over at the waist, and they're so excited to be tilling around in the soil that they start lifting poorly with bad body mechanics and whatnot. So beforehand, I said, okay, what's going to make my life a little easier? And one of those things, when I was scratching in fertilizer and Hollytone and all those different things around my plants, was to get myself a long-handled hoe, one, a little scratcher, so that I wasn't with my handheld one having to crawl around under bushes and around plants digging. So I got myself something with a long handle. And the other thing that I equipped myself with is a rolling cart, and a rolling cart that doubled as a bench, and when the top was open, that was kind of the pull handle for it. And so I was able to load up from my shed my maybe heavier bags of fertilizer, my bag that I was going to hold debris in, tools, things like that. So I had to just do a short, good lift with my knees in order to get my things in my cart, and then I could easily pull them around. And when I got to some place that I needed to be, I could close up that cart top and I could sit on it and prune things for a while instead of bending over. So it's really important we get some of those things. And one other thing, Neil, I got for myself was a nice kneeling cushion, because I tried to figure out what's the most comfortable way to get close to the ground, and bending over at the waist was not comfortable.
Great ideas. That's some things you can do before, and simple things that can make a little difference. You talk about the 1-2-3 approach. So let's talk about during. What about during?
Yeah, while you're gardening, it's really important, first of all, not to have at your yard for like a 6-hour chunk of time, like I used to in days of old. So you might need to limit yourself, maybe even set a timer or have someone call you in, because you'll get lost out there. And way after your back muscles have fatigued, you're still out there. And so you don't want to be crippled by it. So set yourself a nice, reasonable time frame. But now when you're going to approach the ground, because a lot of the things that we do in gardening are on the ground, it's really important, I said earlier, was not to bend over from your waist as much as you can. So when you're going to be digging holes for annuals or planting in perennials, it's much better ergonomics for your back to get down on one knee, or to get down on both knees, and to hinge forward if you're on both knees from your waist in that position. It's much better than hanging the entire weight of your whole upper body over on your waist. So get down close to the ground. Use that that kneeling cushion I was talking about, with one knee on it or two knees on it. And even, Neil, when I was 9 months pregnant, this must have been a sad sight, but I couldn't physically go up and down and up and down. I just couldn't lift all my body weight. And so I crawled on my hands and knees along the border of my garden and dug things in, because it's better to be on knees than it is to be bending over from the waist.
This is probably where we recommend, you know, building a backyard fence before you start doing gardening. So that might be the first.
people aren't looking in at you, wondering sure. what you're doing, yeah. crawling around your yard.
You sort of touched on it about, you know, picking things up, you know, properly. But I'm thinking that oftentimes that I'm down maybe, you know, on a knee or something, I'm reaching and I tend to grab something maybe that's a little heavier than I thought, and suddenly I've tweaked something. I mean, we probably can't say enough about lifting things the proper way.
Yeah, you know, there's really important things, ideas about lifting. One would be, if you're going to lift a large load, you should create an arch in your low back before you go to lift it. So if you do have to bend forward, you're going to bend your knees, but you're going to create a little bit of an arch in your back. That's going to protect the discs. You do want to use the power of your leg muscles in your lift. And, Neil, as you said, a lot of times out of haste, we will reach outside of our body's comfort zone and lift something and pull something, and that's when we get into trouble. So take that extra second to get closer to what you need to lift, closer to what you need to prune, and just be safe with that, because there's a lot of damage that's done in those, like, oh, let me just do it quick, and then we quickly injure ourselves.
Yeah. All right, we're talking a three-part plan for doing yard work with a bad back. We've got before, during. Let's talk after.
Yeah, after is really important. How do you care for your body after you've kind of abused it a bit out there in the garden? I don't know about you, Neil, but when I'm in the garden for a long period of time, even when I've used the best ergonomics that I can and whatnot, I still have to bend over a good deal. And so when I come up to standing from that bent position, I can barely fully stand because my back is so stiff. And so I come into the house and wash up a little bit, and the first thing I do is I lay face down on the floor. What that does is we're going to start to unweight and reverse the pressure that we've caused on our the discs of our spine by bending forward. And so when we come in, you put your hands up out of your forehead so you can look straight down without your neck twisted one way or the other. But just 5 minutes, lie that way. That unweights your discs enough to start the next exercise. After 5 minutes, I have these are called McKenzie extension exercises. I would prop up on my elbows like a little kid watching television, laying on their belly, chin in my hands, and up in that extension position for 30 seconds. I would lay down flat again for 30 seconds, and I repeat that three times. So that's three sets of 30 seconds where I'm kind of halfway extended, propped up on my elbows. And then I follow that up. Now I'm starting to loosen up my back. I'm starting to push my disc material back to the center of my discs where I want it. And then I'm going to go into full extension if it's available to me. So now I'm going to, still lying on my belly, I'm going to place my hands by my shoulders as if I was going to do a push-up. But what I'm going to do instead is something called a press-up. And a press-up is peeling your body, your trunk, up off the floor while your pelvis remains still on the floor. So if you picture almost like a stretching, a yoga stretch position, just arching your back like that. But it is not a stretch position because our discs need to be pumped back into place. And so you'll press up as high as your elbows can straighten, and then you're going to go back down to the floor and press up. It's a repetitive exercise, done 10 repetitions of that. So lying flat first, then propped up on your elbows, and then 10 press-ups done slowly and carefully, not stretching, but just pumping that disc material back to the center so we can get our backs healthy.
I know you've talked about it before, but it's worth repeating that we need to be careful in stretching, right? We think that stretching is the answer to everything, but it's not really, is it?
No, and, you know, it's interesting because when people's backs are tight, the first thing that they do to stretch them is to curl up in a ball or pull their knees up to their chest or something to that manner. But our back muscles are tight when we've bent over frequently. And this doesn't just go for yard work. It could go for working on your car or anything else that has you bending a lot. The reason your back muscles are tight is because it's guarded because your discs have started to migrate or push backwards. And so bending forward just makes that condition worse. So why I'm emphasizing this extension in order to recover from disc tightness, your low back muscles will quiet down and they won't need to be stretched by you bending forward or pulling your knees to your chest. But Neil, if you have really overdone it and it kind of catches you by surprise and you're super sore, people always ask me, should I put heat on my back, take a warm shower, what's the best thing to do? And what I tell them is it depends on the intensity of your pain. So if your low back, on a scale of 1 to 10, if your low back pain is, a 5 and under, it's just like kind of a general achiness, it's probably going to respond best to heat. But if you've really done your back in and you have a 6, 7, 8, 9, a really high level of pain, you need to ice your low back. And people hate ice, but I tell them it's only 10 minutes long, a wet paper towel, an ice pack, lying down, unweighting your discs, and just 10 minutes of that will allow the body to have that anti-spasmodic, anti-inflammatory effect of the ice take place. So that's the best thing you can do if you've really overdone yourself in the garden.
Great insight, as always. A three-part plan for doing yard work with a bad back or really any other activity with a bad back. We've got some good advice from Lisa Marone, as always. She's written about it, Overcoming Back and Neck Pain, just one of her several books, and you could check that out or certainly sign up for her Monday Morning Health Tip. Go to lisamarone.com for that. And Lisa, great advice today. And, no pun intended, we can't wait to have you back.
Thank you.
All right, see you later. Lisa Marone with us. I always love connecting with her every other Monday. And we'll maybe do a little bonus time next Monday, too, just for something different. I hope you enjoyed that conversation and our visit earlier with Tim Muehlhoff, his great new book, Winsome Persuasion, from University Press. We do post our interviews on the show page, so if you missed a portion of it, want to hear it again, or better yet, pass it on to a friend, go to myfaithradio.com and then click on the Connecting Faith show page to find those interviews archived. And join us tomorrow. We're going to talk cleaning house. No, it's not about getting your house clean. It's about cleaning your house from youth entitlement. Kay Wills Wyma is back with us tomorrow on Connecting Faith. Thanks for listening to this Connecting Faith podcast. These conversations are available because of listener support, and you can make a gift right now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of Connecting Faith, you can subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and growing the awareness and impact of Connecting Faith.